Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's the 20th of January 2020. Only 11 days to go to the fabled Brexit. Not really going to talk about that so much today. I'm out and about, just doing my circular perambulation of Barmouth Mountain. Called the Garn in Welsh. It's the big hill at the back of Barmouth, and it's my walk in the park these days is to circle the mountain. And I just got a really nice view over towards Bardsey Island, which is pretty clear, and the end of the Clyne Peninsula. Sun's doing some very interesting heavenly rays behind some big fluffy clouds. It's all kind of rather fine. Yesterday I was talking to Godfrey Devereux about his project of offering workshops on resilience, and by which he means spiritual, psychological resilience in the face of the end of the world. And I hope I'm not sort of characterising it in too cartoonish a way. I've been thinking along similar lines to Godfrey for years actually. But also there are differences too, and I think the difference might be that I have a concern to try and figure out actual organisational matters. For an up and coming velvet revolution, or at least a democratic capture of the state by some humane forces that are interested in social justice, world peace, and the avoidance of ecological catastrophe. And basically being generally anti-capitalist. So there's a question, and it's a question that's hovered around people who think about these kinds of things for as long as I can remember. And it's a question of what is the proper field of play for our reactions to the perception that business as usual is not an option, or that capitalism is intrinsically unjust, or doesn't allow flourishing of human beings, en masse at least. So, and there have been two answers to this really from amongst the chattering classes, maybe. And one is to say that revolution has to be internal. It's to do with enlightenment, or at least some kind of transformation of consciousness makes people less selfish, more eager to help others, less inclined to violence and so forth. And somebody like Krishnamurti writes a book called The Only Revolution, in which he sees this direct and sudden insight into the nature of our being, which transforms us into clear consciousnesses that somehow is able to put aside the destructivity that goes along very often with being human. And of course, if you follow sort of non-Marxist green people, I know people like the Resurgence magazine community, there is some kind of hope in amongst there that this is the necessary transformation of society is brought about by well-meaning people being well-meaning. Over and against this, there's the pure revolutionary types countenance violence if necessary to transform society. And for them, it's all about political action. It's what you're like, doesn't really matter that much. And they would regard the transformed consciousness camp as being utopian or deluded or just at bottom some kind of like apologists for capitalism, middle class apologists for capitalism. And this has been going on since the hippie days. I always characterised the hippie days as having kind of two warring factions, even though it's a slight overdrawing. And on the one hand, you've got the hedonists, drop acid man, do your own thing, or let's retreat to the countryside and have a commune and grow our own soybeans scenario, and perhaps organise ourselves around some kind of religious or spiritual practice. So you have like in America a commune like the farm, which is actually organised around some millennial Christianity, and growing your own food and all the rest of it, and just being wholesome and getting on with it. Build paradise now. And on the other hand, you know, the Maoists and the revolutionaries and the guys who are pretty keen to go on demos, you know, and foment a 1917 style revolution or a Chairman Mao style revolution. I mean, there were overlaps. Obviously, plenty of the politicos weren't averse to dropping acid, and plenty of the hedonists, at least in theory, had the politics of a commissar. But nevertheless, you can see how this conversation has arisen. I just remember John Lennon's song, you know, "You say you want a revolution, but you got to count me out. Change yourself instead," something like that. So, you know, Lennon firmly coming down on the side of that the real revolution happens in consciousness and not on the streets or not in the Houses of Parliament or not in the takeover of the levers of power, of state power, etc. So, and somewhat speculatively, I'd say that there's a part of this tension or quarrel or dialectic that's come out of the way revolutions can go wrong, actual gun-toting revolutions which capture the organs of state, the leaves of state power, can go wrong. And of course, if you're interested in anything vaguely left political, Marxism and so forth, you always get faced with the Stalin question. You know, Stalin was a psychopath and killed millions of his own people, or had them transported to labour camps and all the rest of it, and that this is the argument against any socialist or communist programme would attempt to change society in that general left direction. Of course, it's kind of an empty argument in many ways, and at the same time, it does draw your attention to the connection between the character of leaders and the outcome of revolutions, or even just political programmes in general. I mean, how much of Thatcherism was down to Margaret Thatcher's character and her ability to project it and actualise it in British society? These are actually interesting questions that I think hard-nosed materialist lefties just sneer at, or in my experience over the years they've kind of been sneered at. And here's a question that's full of dangers, because you could end up getting wrapped up in navel-gazing or in identity politics or culture wars, all of which seem to me to be ultimately distractions from the task at hand, even though that's not to say that matters of social justice, you know, it shouldn't be addressed. They should be addressed. But we have to be careful about regarding things as fundamental, which are not fundamental. Where there has been interest, in connecting real political revolution with the character of leaders, there's a few places. I mean, I'm thinking of a writer, not very well known, it's called Joel Cavell, who's a leftist and a psychoanalyst. And he thought that would-be leaders should undergo psychoanalysis to figure out their destructivities and how they might impact on their efficacy as political agents of change, agents of real social change. And it's interesting. I don't know whether it's quite convincing, his account, but at the same time you can't write it off. And of course somebody like Eric Fromm was very concerned to come up with a detailed analysis of character types or personality types of the main Nazis, which he did in a book called The Fear of Freedom, which was written during the war, and also another book called a thick book, very detailed book called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. So this isn't so much about helping lefties to transform their characters so as to become better revolutionaries, but about political leadership with real power of a very destructive and malignant kind, and how that came about and what its structure was, what its anatomy was. Very interesting. So you can see all these efforts are related to the concern I'm talking about. Is it a matter, you know, to what extent do we need to involve our own characters as people who want to change society? And I don't think it's an either-or question, to be honest with you. I don't think we have to be Krishnamurti or Lenin, you know. And that actually brings me to a case where there has been some interesting suggestions along these lines, and that really is the case of existentialism, you know, the classic French existentialism. And I'm thinking of Simone de Beauvoir, perhaps rather more than Jean-Paul Sartre in this instance. And de Beauvoir, writing shortly after World War II in the Ethics of Ambiguity, talks about what it is to be an existentialist. And of course existentialists are very concerned about consciousness. It's their philosophical question in some ways. And and yet de Beauvoir and Sartre, like many French intellectuals of the time, were Marxists. They were in the French Communist Party and so forth. And they'd seen fascism at close hand because they'd been in occupied Paris throughout the war. So they were sobered up as philosophers by that contact with very concrete and toxic and malignant reality of fascist occupation. And I think de Beauvoir captured it in a little phrase. She's asking the question, well, what is it, you know, what should an existentialist be like in terms of their character, but also in terms of the actions that they take to assure some leftist transformation of society, to make it more egalitarian, less prone to the ills of capitalism, and so forth. And the answer to that question, she came up with this little phrase. She said, this person, this revolutionary, is a combination of yogi and commissar. So a little phrase, the yogi and the commissar. Now, I should mention this is also the title of a book by Arthur Kersley, which I think he might have written in the 50s or early 60s. And I think de Beauvoir was writing shortly after the war in the 40s when she came up with this term. So he probably pinched it from her, unless it's one of those good phrases that a few people think of. But I think it's kind of marvellous, the yogi and the commissar. And so what, how do we unpick that? You know, what are the connotations? So the yogi in the popular imagination would be somebody with a fierce self-discipline, not easily swayed, very independent in their own take on things, very self-reliant, very trusting of their own deep experience, very interested in consciousness, really wanting to know what is this. I'm talking about that kind of yogi, you know, the Patanjali self-inquiry yogi. What is this? What's going on? It's not even who am I, it's even more fundamental than that. It's what is this? What is this consciousness? What is this, the world seeing itself? Or this consciousness experiencing itself. So look, the existentialist is the concern for consciousness at the deepest level possible. And through practice, through an actual, well, a somatic practice, as Godfrey has it, and I think it's always somatic. Sitting meditation is somatic. It's not physical yoga, mental yoga. Mind and body distinction can be overdrawn. It's not like we don't find it useful for talking about various things in different ways. That's fine. I refer you to Spinoza on this point. But when push comes to shove, body and mind are not separate. A human being is one thing. So there we've got it. The concern for consciousness and the fierce self-discipline and commitment to integrity and authenticity, where authenticity means being rooted in your own experience and your own practice and the experiences that come out of that practice, being rooted there rather than just accepting dogmas or buying into stories or theologies. So anybody who wants to be politically active and effective, really think about it, they need that ferocity of discipline and that self knowledge, I would say. This is, you know, along similar lines to Joel Covell and perhaps Eric Fromm. But to be a revolutionary, if you don't have self-knowledge, you will yourself become some kind of malignant influence in the world, just as much as any capitalist. So de Beauvoir had that recognition that the character of the revolutionary mattered. So, but the commissar, well, the commissar is a political organiser, somebody who can organise, I don't know, a general strike or a strike or a demonstration or a lobby of the government or the powers that be in some way. Or any kind of action that's needed, civil disobedience, or whatever it might be. And to my mind, this has to be a matter that's appropriate to the the circumstances of a particular society at a particular time, with a particular economic, cultural and historical constellation. And I think there's room for creativity there. I think perhaps the disappointments of the left in recent years do speak of a creative failure, a failure in the creativity to find the new methods for the new times. And I think certainly the ubiquity of information technology as a huge force in our lives is hasn't been caught up with yet. So there's room for imagination there. And I think, again, the spiritual discipline of the yogi, and I've said this many, many times, is actually not like a production of a sort of a statue, a stone Buddha, a sort of, I don't know, unified and highly simplified personality, but quite on the contrary, is extremely creative. You know, the idealised person of the yogi should be that yogi is an artist in some ways. Again, not in any cliched, accepted sense of artist, but in the broader sense of having creative capacities unleashed by the self-discipline and the self-knowledge. So the yogi and the commissar, I think this is right. You know, this is kind of half the job, but fraught with dangers on both sides. You know, as we know, narcissistic navel gazing is one of the traps into which spirituality, inverted commas, particularly modern spirituality, falls, and it becomes unproductive and self-admiring and to do with status and all kinds of stuff, as Godfrey was talking about yesterday. So, care is required, I would say. Wow. The path. The path's like a river. A lot of rain, even though it's been very, very beautiful and fine yesterday, and still pretty fine today. Prior to that, we had some days of heavy rain, and these paths in some places, they just turn into rivers. Anyway, that's an aside. So the yogi and the commissar, and I don't think it requires everybody who is getting ready to get out on the streets, as the French are doing rather admirably, and as the Lebanese are doing rather admirably. It's even happening in Brazil and Argentina, Chile, all over the world. In fact, you know, people are pretty well looking now for some sea change. Obviously, these movements all get articulated in local terms, but nevertheless, the people are on the move. It seems almost accepted in the UK. And the French general strike, which brought the country to a halt for weeks, and assisted by the Gilets Jaunes, has caused Macron, I believe, he has backpedalled a little bit on his desire to increase the pension age. And there's been a million people on the streets day in and day out, you know, and very effective organising. Completely unreported by the UK media. Of course, it's all over Twitter and Facebook, but unreported by the UK media. And I don't expect that in those kind of situations everybody in there is some kind of accomplished yogi, you know, or extremely powerful meditator. Not necessary, but I would say like a sprinkling. A bit like, you put a pinch of salt in some bread just to give it that little lift in the taste. Rather like that. A small percentage, really, of such people can go a very, very long way. And as I say, I've been saying this for ages. I remember in the 60s when I lived in, the first time I lived in Wales, I wrote a play just about this very thing, about somebody caught up in a revolution who underwent a personal crisis as a result of being caught up in an actual real revolution, and kind of had to get their shit together by getting enlightened really quick. It was, you know, a youthful folly in some ways, but just, I'm telling you this to illustrate the idea has been in my mind hell of a long time. Okay, I'm scrambling here a little bit now because, again, I'm avoiding a bit where the path's turned into a swamp. This is why Wales is so beautiful and green. There's wonderful green land there it is. Well, it rains. It rains a lot on the hills, and so instead of having brown hills like you get in sort of southern Spain and Morocco, North Africa and whatever, you've got these beautiful green mountains. Obviously there's other colours, but it's kind of, there's a lot of green and it's luminous. Thanks to the rain, so not going to grumble about it. So, okay. So, this talk, which I didn't really have too much of an idea what I was going to say, really, except this, I've been sort of chewing on this revisitation of the yogi and the commissar. I've just said it's kind of, it's been a debate that's been around for as long as I can remember, and which has been on my mind for a hell of a long time. Okay, so thank you for listening, and I'm hoping we can get up to speed on some podcasts again. I will mention I've got a few things in the can from some of my writings on yoga, and I think Anna and myself are fairly keen to revisit the yogi and the commissar, to revisit the Lao Tzu. But also, I think we're going to try and keep our eyes on the political situation and to carry on analysing various sources and bring in some thoughts to you, which we hope will be useful to you on that matter as well. So, thanks very much. Over and out.